Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zemer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Lori McGee, who's serving as our worship associate.
Words for our chalice lighting are from Jimi Hendrix. When the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace.
Promise of the Spirit, faith, hope, and love abide. So every soul is blessed and made whole. The truth in our hearts is our guide.
We are standing on the side of love, hands joined together as hearts beat as one, emboldened by faith, we dare to proclaim. We are standing on the side of love.
Sometimes we build a barrier to keep love tightly bound. Corrupted by fear, unwilling to hear, denying the beauty we found.
We are standing on the side of love. Hands joined together as hearts beat as one.
The first principle calls us to respect the inherent worth and dignity of every person. It is my favorite of the seven principles. It is the easiest to remember, but often the hardest to apply. When someone tells me that my relationship is ruining the sanctity of marriage, or that it will cause irreparable harm to my children, it is very hard to respect the worth and dignity of that person, let alone maintain my own. But after a deep breath, I remember that I was raised on the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. This, along with our first principle, reminds me that everyone has their story, that everyone comes from a different place, and perhaps some compassion is just what is needed to move the conversation forward to a place where understanding can be found. Perhaps I can open their hearts just a crack to let love in. Perhaps this is wishful thinking, but it is worth a try. Come, let us worship together.
Good morning. This morning we will be honoring Vaughn Wheatley, who has successfully completed the Love and Help Program, which is the Unitarian Universalist Religious Emblem Award for Cub Scouts. Vaughn, Melissa, and I are joined by his father, John Wheatley, who serves as one of Vaughn's den leaders. Vaughn and I met together several times to complete his Love and Help handbook. And in addition to our time together, Vaughn spent a good bit of time with his homework to complete the work for each session. The five topics that we discussed were about me, about my family, about my friends, about my church, and about my beliefs. One of the requirements for this program is that the Scout consider some of the big questions of life. And Vaughn would like to now share with you his big question.
How can we continue using the same things we use today while not hurting the environment? We can make the car electric again. Now the car pollutes the air. If we change it, then we will not pollute the air. We can ride pedal-powered vehicles. Now we don't use pedal power very much. If we change that, we will help the Earth. We can stop using paper and go visual. Now some paper companies waste trees by making paper 0% recycled. If we all go visual, then we will protect the environment.
Thank you, Vaughn. That was really well done. The Cub Scout motto is, do your best, and Vaughn certainly did his best in completing the Love and Help program. He was always well prepared during our sessions, and he worked carefully and thoughtfully, which you just saw, and he allowed himself to go deeper into the experience to learn more about himself and more about Unitarian Universalism. So in recognition of his good work, we have some awards for him.
Vaughn, in honor and recognition of your completion of the Love and Help program, on behalf of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent, I award you with this certificate. Congratulations.
And I award you, Vaughn, with this emblem to be worn on your uniform as the evidence of your accomplishment. And I'd like you to join me in honoring Vaughn with a round of applause. Vaughn's mother and Vaughn's sister, Cordelia, were really helpful in this process, too. And Cordelia is working on her Girl Scout Religion and Life Award, so she'll be up here very soon when she completes. Now, Vaughn is going to help me with our Time for All Ages. He's going to help me spell love with these blocks. Unitarian Universalists all across the country are setting up blocks just like these and wearing T-shirts just like these. We stand next to these boxes because it's a fun way to say that we are standing on the side of love. One way that Unitarian Universalists show that we are standing on the side of love is to gather in public places to show that we care about the fair treatment for all people. In a few days, many Unitarian Universalists in Ohio will gather in the state capitol in Columbus to say that we favor Equal Housing and Employment Act, which would protect the rights of all people, no matter who they love, to live and work wherever they want. But that's just one example of standing on the side of love. The Standing on the Side of Love campaign asks us to harness love's power to stop oppression. To harness love's power to stop oppression. But that sounds kind of complicated to me, and it really doesn't tell us what to do. So let me tell you what I think standing on the side of love can mean. I think it means that whenever we see that there is a need or a problem, we act by doing what we know is right and helpful. I think that we're standing on the side of love whenever we act to help someone in need. I think that even the smallest act of kindness is standing on the side of love. So I have a question for the children here. Children, have any of you ever collected food for people who don't have enough money to buy food? And if so, please come up here and stand with Vaughn and me stand on the side of love with us. Who's ever been involved in that kind of thing? Collecting food. And you can stand on the other side too, Cordelia. Good, come on up. And children, have any of you ever made a choice to do the right thing even though doing nothing would have been easier? And if you've done that, then come on up and stand on the side of love. Anyone out there who's done something when it would have been easier not to do anything? I bet you have, Layla. Come on up here. And children, have any of you ever spoken up or defended a friend who wasn't being treated fairly or who was being teased or bullied? Has anyone ever done that? If so, come on up. I bet some of you that are already up have done that. And I know that, come on up, Leah. You too, Ethan. Come on, let's stand on the side of love. And I know that everyone that's come up here has a story to tell. And I hope to hear all of those stories. And I hope you get a chance to hear some of those stories, too, maybe even today during coffee hour. And I know that if there are any children that didn't come up, that they, too, have stories to tell how they have stood on the side of love. So let our T-shirts remind us and these blocks remind us and our stories remind us to stand on the side of love.
Each time we gather for worship, we set aside time to widen the caring ministry of this congregation. We take time to memorialize those who have died, to celebrate with those who are joyous, and to call into this community of care those we know who need our love and support. We celebrate this morning with Marita Emmert, who's thrilled to share that she officially adopted her foster child, Machiavelli Emmert, this past Tuesday. Congratulations to the Emmert family. And Lori McGee has a sorrow to share. Her aunt, Debbie Hira, has been informed that no further treatments are available for the aggressive cancer she is facing. Lori asks your thoughts and prayers for her aunt, her husband, and their two daughters. Spark of life, sustaining breath, common destiny, great mystery. Sometimes we forget that this life is a miracle. Ordinary miracles abound each and every day. Fingers, toes, plants, rocks, smiles, love. Ordinary miracles surround us each and every moment. May we have eyes to see, ears to hear, and grateful hearts. Let us remember that this life is a gift. We are grateful. Amen. The year before I moved here, Ohio voters approved a constitutional amendment restricting legal marriage with all the rights and privileges it confers for heterosexual people only. Several other states also passed defense of marriage laws that day. As I watched the returns come in, I thought twice about looking for ministry positions in those states that had just enshrined discrimination in their laws. Like gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people across the country, I was discouraged by our setback. But we soon got back to work. Here in Ohio, pro-equality leadership worked hard to get House Bill 176 before the Ohio General Assembly for 4 years in a row. This bill, if it becomes law, would protect all Ohioans from losing their job, being denied housing or public accommodations because of their real or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity. Ranked among the worst in the nation for GLBT rights, this law would help Ohio make significant progress. This past fall, thanks to the leadership of groups like Equality Ohio, the House finally passed House Bill 176. Now our work is to get it passed in the Senate. That's why I'm going to Equality Ohio Lobby Day this Wednesday. I'll be going to Columbus with other Unitarian Universalists from across the state to make it known that we believe all people should be treated with dignity and respect. Like other people of faith, I'm going because I believe it's important for the religious left to be vocal and visible. The religious right is highly organized when it comes to bringing their values to bear on public discourse. If we want liberal religious values to be part of the conversation, we need to show up and speak out. It isn't too late to register to attend, and we're trying to create a carpool from Kent. We'd love to have you join us. I'll be wearing this T-shirt, and all of us who will go will be gathering under a Standing on the Side of Love banner as a way of creating visibility. The Unitarian Universalist Association launched Standing on the Side of Love as a public witness and advocacy campaign last summer. The effort is focused on eradicating oppression and marginalization of people simply because of their identity. It's intended to be an inclusive banner under which we can stand with others, our partners, who also believe in the power of love to stop violence born of fear and hatred. We know that every world religion has compassion at its center. This is a place where we can unite. Thus far, the Standing on the Side of Love campaign has focused on two efforts, one in support of equality for GLBT people and the other in support of dignity and fair treatment for immigrants. Unitarian Universalists had been advocating with and for GLBT people since the 1970s and were nationally recognized as leaders in the struggle for marriage equality. With the help of adult religious education curricula like the Welcoming Congregation series, the average person and the average Unitarian Universalist congregation has been invited to engage with these issues and concerns. As a result, I think most of us are fairly clear about how Unitarian Universalist values speak to GLBT equality efforts. But I'm not so sure that we have such broad consensus when it comes to advocacy on behalf of immigrants. A few weeks ago, I talked during a service briefly about why I think we're called to support comprehensive immigration reform. But with the passage of Senate Bill 1070 in Arizona, the stakes just got even higher. This law gives local law enforcement in Arizona broad powers to investigate the immigration status of anyone who they have reasonable suspicion to believe may be in the country illegally. An immediate and widespread outcry against the legalization of racial profiling prompted the Arizona legislature to amend the law less than a week after its passage. The amended law stipulates that officers may not investigate immigrant status based solely on race, ethnicity, or national origin. The amended law allows police to consider those factors so long as they're not the only factors prompting an investigation. And when they do investigate, this new law stipulates that those immigrants who are not carrying documentation of their legal status can be charged with a misdemeanor. The proponents of the law argue that the federal government's failure to secure the border has compelled them to take that responsibility upon themselves. But with other critics of the law, I believe it will surely result in harassment of people of color, marginalization of immigrants, both documented and undocumented. The author of the Arizona law, Chris Kobach, is a lawyer for a group called FAIR, which stands for Federation for American Immigration Reform. The Southern Poverty Law Center has listed FAIR as an anti-immigrant hate group for the last 3 years. FAIR has an extensive track record of bigotry and racism. They have staff members who have joined white supremacist groups and board members who write for hate publications. Their founder and current board member, John Tanton, has written that, quote, "For European-American society and culture to persist requires a European-American majority and a clear one at that." And their current president, Dan Stein, clearly shares this philosophy, having indicated that he believes, and this is a quote, "immigrants are engaged in competitive breeding aimed at diminishing white power." One of the things that I've learned about racism in my anti-racism analysis training is that whenever racism is built into the fabric of a law, as I believe it is with this law in Arizona, racism will be expressed in the execution of that law. It's true irrespective of the views of individual police officers and judges. This isn't about individuals. It's about a system, the legal system, which will reflect the embedded racism in this law. Now, despite all that, I know that many people, many law-abiding people, will be inclined to support the law because the immigrants it explicitly targets are here in our country illegally, after all. Even people whose ancestors were immigrants themselves might support the law, believing that their ancestors immigrated legally. But what, historically speaking, did it mean to immigrate to this country legally? Before 1875, there was no such thing as legal immigration. As far as the European colonists were concerned, the borders were open and immigration was unrestricted. No one consulted the native people living here to determine how they felt about European immigration. In 1875, the first law was passed limiting who could enter the United States. Undesirable people, that's what it said, including criminals, prostitutes, and Chinese workers, were excluded with this first law. In 1882, that law was expanded to forbid any Chinese immigrants for any reason. It wasn't until 1921 that a quota system was put into place limiting immigration based on nationality, but it's important to note that Western Europeans were exempt from any quotas. In 1965, our federal government acknowledged that the quota system wasn't fair or flexible and completely overhauled our nation's immigration laws. The system we have now is incredibly complex, with three distinct categories of status, including United States citizens, lawful permanent residents, and legal non-immigrants. Each category has its own qualifications, which I don't have time to explain fully, But the Quaker Friends Committee on National Legislation has a really helpful overview of the three categories and the pathways by which a person can strive to attain legal status that I'd recommend to you. I encourage you to take a look at it because as I read it, the bottom line is that it's almost impossible for low-wage, low-skilled workers to legally immigrate to the United States today. So why do they come? Why do people who know that they cannot enter our country legally and who realize they will have limited opportunity and additional burden placed upon them as a result of their undocumented status come to this country anyway? Many come to reunite with family members. As the well-respected Immigration Policy Center points out, the backlog on family-based immigration is so long that it usually takes many years, and that's for closest relatives, and in some cases over a decade for more distant relatives to be allowed to legally immigrate. Many spouses, parents, children, and siblings choose to immigrate illegally rather than spend years separated from their loved ones. But what of those loved ones who are already here? Why did they come? Global economics have created conditions of desperate poverty in many countries. For instance, many who come to the United States from Mexico were once farmers. NAFTA and other agreements have made our grain less expensive than grain grown locally in Mexico, thereby impoverishing many Mexican farmers and eliminating their jobs. But ironically, our agricultural system wouldn't function without the labor of some of those now undocumented Mexican workers. As the Immigration Policy Institute explains, the reason those Mexican workers are undocumented is because our current immigration law allows only 5,000 green cards for low-wage, low-skill workers per year for the whole entire United States. 5,000 for the whole United States. The demand for low-wage, low-skill workers by U.S. employers dramatically exceeds that limit, creating an incentive for would-be workers to immigrate illegally in search of economic opportunity. And even when those jobs are only temporary, the enforcement efforts at our border discourage workers from migrating back to their country of origin for a time because the risks of trying to enter again for another period of employment are so great. This situation keeps many people permanently living in the United States who might otherwise prefer to live here only temporarily during periods of seasonal or other temporary employment. And of course, it's been brought to our attention repeatedly in the national news of recent years that undocumented legal status enables unscrupulous employers to take advantage of those workers. We also can't overlook the fact that war and political persecution have long been incentives for people to migrate. I didn't realize until recently that the way our current law is constructed, it's not possible for a person to seek asylum in the United States until they are here in the United States. That means that people fleeing persecution have to enter our country illegally or overstay their temporary visas in order to be considered for asylum. The other thing I think is important to acknowledge is that the crime that's being committed when a person enters the country without border inspection, which is about half of the undocumented immigrants in this country, or when a person overstays their temporary visa, is only a civil infraction. On the scale of lawbreaking, it compares with getting a speeding ticket. Now, I've gotten a couple of speeding tickets in my life, I'm sorry to say, but to my knowledge, no one has ever referred to me as a criminal because of it. Finally, I want to address the concerns I sometimes hear expressed about undocumented immigrants not paying taxes and burdening our social service system. The reality is that property and sales taxes are required of people irrespective of their immigrant status, and many undocumented immigrants have also state and federal taxes deducted from their paychecks. In 2008, the Social Security Administration reported that undocumented immigrants alone, have contributed over 8 years of viability to the Social Security system, a system from which they are barred from receiving benefits, just as undocumented immigrants are barred in many states from receiving any public benefits funded by federal money. I take the time today to explore some of the nuances of immigration in our country in depth because I believe our immigration system is broken and badly in need of repair. As it stands, families are separated, workers are exploited, and every year desperate people die trying to cross the Sonoran Desert. The system we have doesn't work, and the people who live on the border with Mexico probably understand that better than most. But unfortunately, Arizona's new law seems to me a lot like blaming the victim. It can only serve to frighten and harass brown-skinned immigrants, documented and undocumented alike. Desmond Tutu is one of the many leaders who have spoken out against this law. These are his words. Abominations such as apartheid do not start with an entire population suddenly becoming inhumane. They start with generalizing unwanted characteristics across an entire segment of the population. They start with stripping people of rights and dignity, such as the right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty that you yourself enjoy. When you strip a man or a woman of their basic human rights, you strip them of dignity in the eyes of their family, in their community, and even in their own eyes. In our faith tradition, we affirm the inherent worth and dignity of all people. Wherever people are oppressed because of their identity, we are called to witness. Wherever people are degraded because of the color of their skin or the accent of their tongue, we are called to respond. I believe that our faith tradition calls us to speak out against this law in Arizona and to organize against the passage of similar laws here or anywhere else in the country. I said earlier that our current system of immigration is incredibly complicated. The process for reforming our immigration laws will be challenging, and reasonable people will surely disagree about the details. I'm certain of that. But I'm also certain that we can come together around a few basic principles. All people should be treated with dignity and respect. Nobody should be harassed, exploited, or oppressed because of their race, ethnicity, or the color of their skin. All immigration laws must be fair and humanely enforced. Family unity needs to be a priority. The circle of love has a wide embrace. With love as our guide, everything is possible. May we dare to dream sweet dreams of peace and do the work to make them real. Amen, and blessed be.
Our closing words today come from texts of various world religions. These words, which reflect some variation of the Golden Rule, illustrate that no matter the differences in our doctrinal beliefs, we can still treat each other with respect, compassion, and love. Please rise and let's join our voices together. I will read the regular print. The congregation will please read the italics. These are found in your order of service. All things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye so to them, for this is the law and the prophets.
Do not do to others what you would not like yourself. Then there will be no resentment against you, either in the family or in the state.
Hurt not others in ways that you yourself would find hurtful.
This is a sum of duty. Do not unto others what you would not have them do unto you.
No one of you is a believer until he desires for his brother that which he desires for himself.
What is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow man. This is the entire law. All the rest is commentary.
Regard your neighbor's gain as your gain and your neighbor's loss as your own loss.
We have gathered in dedication to the proposition that beneath all our diversity, there lies a unity which binds us one to the other, to the earth, and to the stars. We've gathered in witness. Let us take our witness out into the world. Go in peace.